If you open up almost any prayer book to the Torah service, you will find a series of Misha Berachs, prayers that we say for individuals experiencing significant moments in their lives. Here on a Shabbat morning, for example, you may have noticed that our Siddur Sim Shalom includes a Misha Berach for couples who are soon to be married, for young people becoming bar or bat mitzvah, for parents who have just given birth, as well, of course, for those who are ill. These are all events that are part of the fabric of life and that we mark with joy, or at least with hope, surrounded by our community's embrace. So I smiled when I recently saw a different Misha Berach in the new Siddur that's used by our conservative Masorti sister congregations in Israel. A blessing for an Olech Hadash, a new immigrant. Misha Berach Avotenu, may God who blessed our fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and our mothers Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and who commanded Lech Lecha, go forth from your native land and from your father's house, and who planted in the heart of our people in every generation longing and love of Zion. Bless this Olech Hadash, who has left his country, the land of his birth, and his father's house, and who has fulfilled the mitzvah of Aliyah to the land of Israel. May the Holy One, blessed be He, give him strength and courage and deepen his roots in the earth of this land and send blessing and success to the works of his hands, along with all of Israel, his brothers and sisters in the state of Israel. May it be God's will, and let us say Amen. I kept thinking about that Misha Berach on a Monday afternoon in August, just about 6 weeks ago, as Fran and I stood in Terminal C at Kennedy Airport and waited for our son Jonah to board a plane. Although he told us years ago when he was still in high school that he planned on making Aliyah and living in Israel, college graduation seemed so far away, and we paid little attention to Jonah's long-term plan until this year, his senior year at JTS in Columbia. It seemed to catch us almost by surprise. But this was the year that Jonah opened up a file with the Jewish agency, got his paperwork in order, and met regularly with a group of other college seniors who would soon be together on this flight, leaving Kennedy Airport for Tel Aviv. It was quite a scene. 360 people from all over the United States were making Aliyah on that particular Monday afternoon, on an LL flight chartered by Nefesh B'Nefesh, the organization that works with the Jewish agency to prepare individuals and families for their Aliyah and to help ease the transition on the other end. The youngest person embarking on this life-altering journey that day was 5 months old, and the oldest was 82. And among those who boarded that plane were families with children, 120 children to be exact, 133 singles, 10 dogs, a cat, and a pet python. And from what I could see, dozens of stuffed animals. Since 2002, 30,000 North Americans have taken such flights in order to make Israel their new home. Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetecha u'mibeit avicha el ha'aretz asher areka. Go forth, God said to Avram, from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I wondered, how did Abraham and Sarah pack for the journey? What of their previous lives did they leave behind, and what were they able to take with them? Jonah was allowed 3 suitcases, a maximum weight of 50 pounds each. Among the singles flying that day were 104 young adults who, like Jonah, were part of a group called Garin Tzabar. Garin Tzabar helps settle Olim between the ages of 18 and 23 who are coming alone without their families and who will soon be Chayalim Bodedim, lone soldiers in the Israeli armed forces. That, by the way, was why he was allowed 3 suitcases instead of 2. The third suitcase was a privilege courtesy of El Al for those who are about to enter the army. Garin Tzabar settles them in small groups on kibbutzim and villages, which will be their home away from home after they enlist, and where they will be matched with adoptive families who will provide some extra TLC. Garin Sabar helps them negotiate the red tape of becoming an Israeli citizen and of preparing for their enlistment. Jonah's home away from home will be Moshav Regba, a small village in the far north near Nahariya and not far from the beach. Until recently, I had never heard of Garin Sabar, and my guess is that most of you have not either. So let me tell you. It was started about 20 years ago by the Israeli Scouting Movement with the goal of helping Israeli-American kids come home and enter the army even though their parents were living abroad here in America. They used to bring over about 20 young people a year. But 3 years ago, the numbers mushroomed to over 100, most of whom were not the children of Israelis, but were American-born children of American Jews, like Jonah. The next year, the numbers jumped to 250, and this year, 350 kids from across North America will be making Aliyah through Garin Sabar. And of course, many other young people make Aliyah directly on their own, without this program. Just last year, Paula Waters from our congregation fulfilled her own dream of living in Israel and moved to Tel Aviv. So the first thing I want you to take home today is this. The reports of American Jewish youth's disengagement with Israel are greatly exaggerated. Israel has the power to inspire hundreds of idealistic young people every year to do what most of us do not have the courage to do, to leave the sidelines and to take center stage in building the Jewish people's future by moving to Israel. Nor were we the only Temple Israel of Natick family hugging a soon-to-be IDF soldier that August day. Isaac Rajan was leaving on the same flight, part of the same program, heading for his new home at Kibbutz Magen, not far from the Gaza Strip. Along with the extended Lieben and Rajan Manning families, the Brants and the Silvermans were on hand that day to take pictures and to lend moral support, to smile with pride, to give hugs to the boys before their flight, and to cry. It was a scene. 360 people waiting to pass through El Al security, accompanied by hundreds of family and friends who had come to see them off, in a line that snaked forever through the airport terminal. You had to ask yourself, what is motivating them, these families and young people? What visions and dreams and hopes for the future are giving them the strength to leave behind the comforts of home and family, of language and culture, of the known and the familiar? As the Garin Sabar kids checked in, they were given a placard, not a required form, but something just for fun. It was an unfinished sentence completion that read, "I am making Aliyah for blank," and they were asked to fill it in. So all through the terminal were fresh-faced, beautiful kids with these signs on which they had markered in their completion of the sentence, "I am making Aliyah for myself. I am making Aliyah for the Jewish people. I am making Aliyah for the small things, for adventure, for the uniform, for me, for the babes, for the heck of it. I am making Aliyah for those who can't, to come home to my family, for love, for the Jewish state and its defenses, for a great future. I am making Aliyah forever." The Torah texts that we read for Rosh Hashanah recall steps along the journey of Abraham and Sarah. It is an archetypal journey filled with joys and sorrows and great, sometimes overwhelming challenges. And we recognize pieces of our own life journeys mirrored in theirs. But their journey is far more than a spiritual metaphor. It is a challenge to create something very specific, a nation set apart in its own land and yet set apart in order to bring blessing into God's world. Lech lecha, go forth to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and all the families of the earth shall be blessed through you. When people ask me, what in essence does being Jewish mean? I often answer by returning to these very verses, to the charge of Abraham and Sarah in Lech Lecha. To be Jewish is to walk in their footsteps, that is, to be God's partners in bringing blessing to the world. It's that simple. But we don't do it alone. We do it through building communities in which blessings can be made concrete, in which societal issues of war and peace, of economic justice and social equality are played out. And nowhere can that drama be played out in all its messiness and intricacies Jewishly than in the Jewish state. And that, I suspect, is a big piece of what motivated those 360 people boarding the El Al flight that August day. Several years ago, while sitting at our Shabbos table one Friday night, I looked at Jonah and I said, "So Jonah, so what will you really do in Israel if you make Aliyah?" He waited for a moment and, looking thoughtfully at his parents, he responded, "I think I'd like to start a microbrewery in the Negev." When I asked him the same question more recently, shortly before he left this summer, a more matured young man responded, "I want to be a liberal Zionist in Israel and raise a pack of liberal Zionists in Israel because Israel needs more of them." Jonah is nobody's fool. He knows that Israelis, worn down by terrorism and a failed peace process, have veered to the right, that hope for a two-state solution that will preserve Israel as both Jewish and democratic recedes with every new West Bank outpost that breaks ground, and that the Orthodox establishment grows more hostile to non-Orthodox Jewish expression with every election cycle. Jonah doesn't like any of these trends, but he wants to live in Israel so that he can make a difference. It's easy to be cynical. And by cynical, I mean to think that you already know how things will turn out and that it won't be good. We live in times when Israel is more isolated diplomatically than it has been in years. Turkey is throwing away its traditional alliance with Israel in a bid for leadership in the Muslim world. The cold peace with Egypt has never been more tenuous. And in the United Nations, Abu Mazen postures to his core audience, who challenge the very legitimacy of the Jewish state. And yet, cynical is not who we are. Other cultures imagine Judgment Day as something that comes either when you die or at some apocalyptic end of history when it will be too late to do anything about it. But we Jews, we have our Yom HaDin, our Judgment Day now, today, in the middle of living our lives, when we celebrate the aspect of newness and rebirth that is inherent in everything. Rosh Hashanah teaches us to have faith in the possible, even in face of tough odds. We can change our lives, and the world can change its course. That's the essence of Jewish faith. And whether they define themselves as religious or secular, or in Jonah's case, simply as spiritual, those passengers on the flight to Tel Aviv all had faith. Faith that through their individual choices, in this case, the choice to make Aliyah, they can make a difference in the world. We all walk in the footsteps of Abraham. So whether we decide to get on an El Al plane to forge a new life in Israel or not, the question for us is still the same. How do we want to change in the coming year? And what can we do to bring some measure of blessing into a world that so badly needs it? When we talk about Abraham's journey, however, the elephant in the room is the inscrutable story that is the climax of tomorrow's reading, the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. How could Abraham have done that, we ask ourselves. And in what possible way can this serve as a model for our own life journeys? The only way to begin to understand is to see that for Abraham not to have listened to God would have felt like a betrayal of self. It would have left him anchorless, adrift in a world that had lost its meaning. And so perhaps the way to pose the question for ourselves is, what are the risks that we are willing to take? What are we willing to lose in order to feel whole, in order to feel connected to our truest selves, in order for our place in things to make sense? Are we able to stand up and say what we think is right, even when doing so may jeopardize our comfort in some way? Would we sacrifice a job for our principles, even though we need to pay the bills? Will we write a larger check than we know we can afford in order to support a greater good? Faith begins in the place where we know that we are connected to something larger than ourselves. It's the only thing that gives us the strength to make meaningful sacrifices in life. Frankly, I stand a little bit in awe of those 104 kids who joined Garin Sabar this year. I'm sure some of them are religious and others are not, but their faith challenges me. At this season of Teshuva, repentance is not about hanging our heads in shame and saying, "I'm sorry." It's about doing the best that we can to make things right so that we can return to our sense of wholeness and connection. It restores our faith in the meaning of things, revitalizes us, and assures us that the path we walk has meaning beyond our own existence. For every human being, this is a personal journey, as it was for Abraham. But for us as Jews, it's also a communal journey. Ahavat Yisrael, the love of all Israel for one another, means that we share in each other's sorrow and we rejoice in each other's joys. We know this from our own experience. And Israel, the land, is an inextricable thread in the cord that binds us. To walk away from her when the politics are difficult or simply because the news is simply too painful is to walk away from a piece of ourselves. It damages our sense of wholeness, and we do so at our peril. If you weren't following the news closely this summer, you might have missed the fact that there was something of a social revolution in Israel. It began on July 14th when 25-year-old Daphne Leif pitched a tent in Habima Square in central Tel Aviv. Through Facebook, she invited others to join her in protesting the high cost of rent, which had ballooned in recent years. Within a day, dozens of tents sprouted along Rothschild Boulevard. Within a week, thousands of mostly young Israelis had coalesced at a rally in the city. And in the following weeks, what had begun as a protest over real estate prices began to include broader demands for economic reform and social justice. Working mothers marched with strollers to bring awareness to the issue of affordable daycare. Israelis shared their concern over the fraying safety net, the growing gap in Israel between rich and poor, and the need to return to the social vision of Israel's Zionist founders. Each week saw more tent cities and rallies in greater numbers in a nonviolent Israeli version of the Arab Spring. Rock stars led the people in Shehecheyanu, acknowledging a long-dormant sense of unity of purpose and Zionist pride as strangers shared hummus and ice cream and dreams for Israel's future. By September 3rd, the social justice protests, as they became known, culminated in a national event of more than 460,000 people. Voices from across the establishment reached out in support of this grassroots phenomenon. Before that rally, Tzipi Livni, head of the Kadima Party, wrote on her Facebook wall, "Come protest tonight. I hope the masses come. I know, no matter what, that the protesters of summer 2011 brought about the change that Israel needs. The Israel that the protesters want is the country I want for my children. A technical economic change is not enough. We need a change in values and joint vision. This is the new Zionism." And former chief Ashkenazic rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, told a group of student protest leaders, "This is the first time I remember ever having seen this many people who didn't know each other before coming together outside of a time of war." He said, "You have captured my heart." Now, I don't know yet what concrete changes will come about as a result of Israel's kumbaya moment in the streets this summer. But I was moved by the spectacle of 500,000 Israelis, citizens of one of the world's most vibrant democracies, affirming that change is possible, that dreams of tikkun olam, of perfecting a just and caring society, are attainable one person at a time. And all of this in spite of an unrelenting state of war and Qassam rockets from Gaza that now reach farther into Israel's heartland than anyone really wants to admit. My friends, I believe with all my heart that the return of the Jewish people to its ancient homeland after 2,000 years is the great miracle of the 20th century, and that we are blessed for being alive in this generation. But sometimes we have to remind ourselves of our blessings. It was Israel who, in her first decade, not only provided a home for survivors of the Shoah, but absorbed over 600,000 refugees from Arab countries. It was Israel who absorbed 1 million Russian Jews and rescued by airlift the Jewish community of Ethiopia. It is Israel who is a first responder to earthquakes and other natural disasters around the globe, sharing her hard-earned expertise in crisis control and human aid. And it is in Israel where Hebrew, the language of the Bible, was revived, and where the Jewish people, against all odds, have re-entered the stage of history, where Jewish thought, values, and morals are put to the test every day in the ongoing business of running a country. And we who are here, even given our own serious economic and social challenges, sit in relative comfort and safety. What will we do to nurture and to protect and to further the living reality of this miracle we call Israel? For it is our heritage and our blessing, just as it was Abraham's. So here are a few mostly simple things that I would like to suggest that we can do this year. And none of them rely on a particular brand of politics. First, be better informed. Make the Jerusalem Post or Haaretz your computer homepage, or follow Israel on one of the many great blogs out there, so that you can more accurately represent Israel at work and among your friends. Become more familiar with Israeli culture by coming to our monthly Israel film series, or Wednesday night Israeli dancing, or by reading Israeli authors or listening to Israeli music. Sign up for the adult ed course that we're offering this fall called Engaging Israel and learn what Zionism then and now really means. Visit Israel. It's been 3 years since our last temple trip, and it's time to go again. Some of you have already expressed your interest, and I so look forward to sharing some of the places and people that I love with you. Volunteer in Israel. Join our own Stephen Carroll Doppelt, who lead a 4-week volunteer mission every winter in Haifa, Boston's sister city. Talk to them, or to Maury and David Sachs, and find out why Haifa has become a second home for them, to which they joyfully return each year. And if you have an elementary school-age child or grandchild, enroll her in Passport to Israel. Passport is a partnership program between CJP, the synagogue, and the family. Each puts $100 into a savings plan each year so that when your child is old enough to take a teen trip to Israel, the trip will already be partially funded. This is a no-lose proposition for families. CJP and the synagogue are giving you money. And if you decide not to send your child on such a trip, your full contribution is returned. But most of our kids do go on teen trips, either with Jewish summer camps or USY or other groups. Our Temple Passport to Israel committee can help you find the Israel Summer Experience High School Abroad program that is right for your child. It is a gift that could change their lives. And if there is a college age or post-college young adult in your life who never had the Teen Israel experience, it's not too late. Encourage them to go on Birthright. Birthright trips are free, and their impact on literally thousands of young people has been profound. Last year, I married a couple that met on a free Israel trip for young professionals, and they told me that 3 other weddings resulted from the same trip. I want to share with you one final image of Israel this summer, of a wedding that I attended just a few weeks ago. the marriage of my nephew Boaz to his bride Adi. In Israel, the joining together of two families at a wedding often has the feel of kibbutz galuyot, of the prophetic ingathering of the exiles. The bride and the groom were both native Israelis, but between them, their parents hailed from Israel, South Africa, the United States, and Yemen, literally the four corners of the globe. And here they stood, beneath a chuppah under the stars, at a kibbutz nestled in the hills of Jerusalem. I sang the first three of the seven wedding blessings, representing the Americans. An elderly relative of the groom chanted the next two in a Yemenite accent and trope, stirring memories of an ancient tradition transplanted to Israeli soil. The modern Orthodox Ashkenazi rabbi who gave the final two blessings rounded out the picture, representing the state of Israel. For me, a wedding in Israel is biblical prophecy fulfilled before our very eyes. The seventh blessing, my favorite, includes the phrase, Mehera Adonai Eloheinu Yishama Be'arei Yehuda Uvechutzot Yerushalayim Kol Sason Vekol Simcha Kol Chatan Vekol Kala. Adonai our God, may there always be heard in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem voices of joy and gladness, of happiness, voices of bride and groom, the jubilant voices of those joined in marriage under the chuppah, and the voices of young people feasting and singing. After the ceremony, 375 guests danced in between dinner courses for hours, everything from Israeli rock and roll to traditional Yemenite folk music. The DJ finally finished at 1:45 in the morning, but these people were not finished partying. No sooner did the music stop than all the young people headed for the swimming pool a few yards away and jumped in. The men stripped down to their trunks, and the women jumped in their dresses, including the bride, in her wedding dress. I looked at my sister, who gasped, "Oh God, that's a rented dress." "No," said a guest who overheard her, "so it will dry." "Well," I said to my sister, "this is the first time I ever witnessed the bride immersing in the mikveh." And then I saw Adi, the bride, joined by her whole family in the pool, her mother, her father, her siblings, all holding each other in a circle in the water with such smiles of love and contentment. If there is a definition of joy, I thought to myself, I think I'm looking right at it. The Hasidic tradition teaches that the fall holidays are similar to a wedding. At Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we are like the bride and groom who take stock of their lives and prepare to enter a covenant of love. We ask, what is it that God the Beloved expects of us? How can we best serve as a vessel of blessing in this world? Sukkot is the bridal canopy, and Simchat Torah is the joy that results in a life that has found its purpose. At a wedding, nobody looks at a bride and groom with envy, thinking, "Oh, I wish I had what they have." Rather, we tap into a shared joy, a collective joy that nourishes and fills us. This year, may our joy increase as we each come closer to discovering our purpose. May we rededicate ourselves to the mitzvah of Ahavat Yisrael, rejoicing in our love for the Jewish people and for the land of Israel. It is our unique path of blessing, as it has been ever since Abraham and Sarah first stepped forth. L'shana tova tekatevu v'techatemu. May you be written and inscribed in the book of life for a year of happiness and health, of joy and fulfillment. Amen.